for having me as the first lecturer like in this series marketplace talk. I was your first also guest on the podcast, if I remember, right?
Yes.
Exactly. So I'm more than happy to be your guinea pig in every experiment you decide to make in the future. So
indeed.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you for everyone for joining. I will make it as much as possible to reduce the talk to around 30 to 40 minutes, and maybe to leave out the rest of the time for questions, discussions, or maybe to dig deeper maybe to certain topics, because somehow I'm going to cover a whole range of topics. I will try as much as possible not to be too technical on certain stuff, but actually we need to introduce some tech stuff, sexy tech stuff. So the talk is going to be divided into three main parts. First of all, just to put the talk into the context, part one, I'm going to talk about how to redefine the digital calculus. By digital calculus, I mean the digital stewardship, how we manage our data, how we consume our data, how we consume services, softwares, even hardware in our daily lives. In the part two, I'm going to talk about how actually with real life examples, we need to redefine this digital calculus, introducing technologies, some sort of technologies. We're going to talk more deeper into blockchain, AI, AGI, artificial general intelligence, etc. And then at the end, just like an open up for how do we imagine the future and how we need to start today working towards this future. So that's it. I hope you will enjoy it and feel free to ask whatever you want. And I hope this will be at the end of the lecture, like a more interactive one where we can discuss certain topics, because if you're a tech savvy or not, this subject directly affects you in your daily life. So to start with, the way in real life we interact peer-to-peer between each other, so we rely basically on two main things: basic human trust and accountability. So let's give a small example. When you go down to grocery shop to buy, let's say, anything you want, there's this mutual unexpressed trust between you and the place you are buying, between the value of money you're giving, what type of product you are getting in return. And if this doesn't go as you decided to or whatever, there's the accountability. So we base everything on our basic human stuff and accountability. This is not perfectly true when we talk about the digital world. In the digital world where we interact with Google search, we send emails, we conduct business, we buy on e-commerce website, etc. Every one of us is part of someone else's transaction. What do I mean by someone else's transaction? Yes, let's take, for example, an e-commerce website. Yes, there's the terms of use. There's this general understanding of protecting your credit cards when you're buying stuff. And based on this alleged, promise that you will get the product you bought. But behind the scenes, all your data, all your traffic is being recorded, analyzed, sold, reused by data brokerage firms, the actual website you are using, and so many deep layers of people interacting with each other and agencies interacting and buying and selling and monetizing your data. So in the digital world, user, you, me, everyone, we are part of this someone else transaction. So that's why the internet is a great place. We share our news, we interact with friends, we conduct our business, etc. But somehow we lost our way in the internet, or the internet has lost its way. We've heard about big scandals like Cambridge Analytica, where firms used personal data to target people during the last US election, etc., using algorithms. We've heard about bias, algorithm bias against African Americans on Facebook, specifically regarding the facial recognition algorithm they implemented. So that's why we need to take two steps back and try to rethink this digital calculus, how to redefine it, how to try to fix it, so we can go as human beings towards this big promise we have to survive from one side, and from the other side to try to use technology in the right way to solve our real world problems. So we need to reverse the course of actions where tech is now empowering people rather than reducing people on the internet. So within this notion of digital calculus, let's break it down into three big components, try to get this overview look of the scene. So we have from one side the tech world. When I say tech world, it includes basic technology, the infrastructure between cloud, the actual connection, fiber optics going all over the world, etc. The second part is the players or stakeholders. This includes users, you and me, agencies, companies, private companies, governmental entities, so website, cloud providers, etc. And the third part is the set of rules that govern this digital world. So how do we process our payments? How do we if it's allowed to hack something or not, etc. And here the set of rules includes the governmental regulations, the world consensus about ethics on the internet, bullying, etc. So we've divided this digital calculus between these three parts: the tech world, the players, and the set of rules that governs this ecosystem. What if we are working towards a better web, a better digital stewardship? We need to focus on a simple core or key factor, is to preserve the right of autonomy for users. By autonomy, I mean freedom of thought, freedom of control of the data, etc., and also the freedom of action for the agencies. By agencies, again, I mean websites, Amazon, Google, etc., as private companies on the internet. So we need to preserve the autonomy, freedom of thought, freedom of control for the users, and freedom of actions for all agencies on the internet. So now we've defined this digital stewardship or digital calculus. Now I'm gonna define on the micro level each of these three parts and talk about how or where the vulnerability are and how we can work on improving this. So let's take the tech world. The tech world, we've said that it's the combination of technologies, networks, infrastructure, computational systems, etc. This part is divided into three subcategories, which includes data in general. So try to imagine the flow of data coming in and out from the web. Anything from the pictures we take with our phones, posted on Instagram, Facebook, to the data flowing from IoT devices at the edge, from healthcare, biomedical devices. So everything. So we're talking about data flowing in the web and out of the web. Number two, second subcategory is the algorithms. So we are governed by algorithms, whether we know it, you know it or not. The flow of data coming in and the flow of data coming out of the web to the real world is governed by algorithms. Third subcategory is the interference part, or the platforms that enables this receiving the data, feeding these data to the algorithms, collecting the analysis, the prediction, and pushing out results to the user. So this is the basically the tech world and the dynamic happening within this computational system. So we've said tech world. Second part was the stakeholders or the players. We've talked about users, agencies, private companies, private tech companies, basically cloud provider, etc., and governments. And the third part, we talked about the rules. So I'm gonna stress now, this is the mainly the core of the talk, where we need to discuss the rules that governs the relationship between the stakeholders and how the computational system affects these players and how these players are trying to work with these computational system to twist forces. I'll try to extract as much value as possible out of this digital world. So when we talk about rules, nowadays rules on the internet are basically a combination of two things. Real world regulations set up by governments, authorities, policymakers, etc., and internal policies set out by private agencies, companies like Amazon, Google, Microsoft, etc. What is more important when we talk about rules is the lack of certain kind of, and I'd like to call it ethos, where these two words between the governments, policymakers, etc., and private agencies do not intersect and do not take into consideration the well-being of this whole digital system. We can give examples regarding this. I think you are familiar with what Edward Snowden have done, his work in his book released Permanent Record, where he actually informed the whole world how some government agencies, with the collaborations of private agencies, private companies on the internet, is running a massive surveillance system on people, flagging people out, collecting as many records as possible, even for people without any suspicions behind them whatsoever. So this is all due to the lack of ethos that governs this digital calculus or digital world. The most important thing we need to talk about while we try to imagine how the ethos of the future of this digital calculus should be is reshaping or redefining what a user is. When we talk about this and we dig deeper into defining what is a user on the internet and who's a user on the internet, we need to talk about security. Security is a very big word that covers a lot of notions, but specifically when we talk about flow of data, ownership of data, etc., when we talk about security, we define three main components regarding security of data. These components are the integrity, the confidentiality, and privacy. These are big notions, and we can discuss each and every one. And this, it might take many lectures. But in the context of the notion of big data, integrity, confidentiality, and privacy are the three main components we need to tackle to preserve and try to shape and define to push for a new digital calculus that governs basically the way we interact with each other or we conduct business globally on the internet. So what is exactly integrity of data? So I'm gonna try to explain this using some sort of examples. So let's say you are a healthcare company, a big pharmaceutical company conducting clinical research for a drug, clinical research or drug research discovery, etc. So if any of these big set of data specifically related to this clinical trial gets leaked, or we found out that someone within this research team had the access to this data, and this directly breaches all the regulations set up by the regulator in a certain country. Even if this data is not tampered or leaked publicly, and still anonymized, the fact that someone had the ability to access the data against the regulator's policies, this directly affects the integrity of the whole research or clinical trial. So if we're talking about, again, the pharmaceutical industry, this is basically a loss of around billions of dollars, because the regulator now will forbid the pharmaceutical company to use this data to be published in research, in research publications, lectures, etc., because the integrity of the data itself has been affected. When we talk about the second core of ethos is the confidentiality of data. Confidentiality means when player A and player B are working with each other on a set of data, collaborating, let's say sending data, receiving data from the other end, and they both need to preserve this interaction and without giving the ability to anyone outside of this small ecosystem between player A and player B to know what kind of interaction is happening or the identity of both. So this is what we call confidentiality. So confidentiality of the data is preserving the agreement between player A, player B about the rule of the game of how they are collaborating over the data between each other. Third component is privacy. Also, privacy is a big notion, but again, I'm going to use some sort of example to express what is privacy in the digital sense. So privacy in the digital sense is actually not locking your data in some sort of data silos and not showing this to anyone, but rather having the proof of ownership of this data and the control to let's say user B to access it, try to use it, analyze it. So privacy is more closely related to having controlling the access in and out of your private data, plus the proof of ownership that you own this data. So just take a small recap. I know this is a bit too much to process, but so a quick overview, the digital world, or if we wanted to try to define how we interact with data, how we manage data, how we consume softwares, services on the internet, is divided into three main components. The tech world, computational systems, includes technology, hardware we use, softwares, etc. The stakeholders, the players, us users or private company, private agency on the internet. And number three, the set of rules that governs the relationship between these two. So we have identified a problem between how we are conducting our business on the internet and how we are controlling the data in respect of how users on the internet does not have the full control and access of their personal data and information. And later on, I'm going to give more examples to make this more clear. So how do we approach such a complex relationship and try to avoid the worst, but at the same time gain taking advantage of the benefits of this? So it's simple. We need to produce more of what we want out of this tech world and all the benefits coming in from these technologies. And from the other hand, produce less of what we don't. So we need to reverse the downside and to gain on the upside. So when we talk about computational system, then the normal internet we use, most of cloud providers, you guys know, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, etc. These are all centralized systems. So yes, they are all over the globe having servers with latency speed less than 2 milliseconds from all over the major conglomerates around the world. But these are centralized systems where a limited amount of people have the keys and controls over all approximately 80 to 90% of everyone's data locked in cloud storage systems or on-premise servers. So this is one of the main problems we have, these centralized systems where the keys to control your data is within someone else's power or hands. Hence, the big technological breakthrough that came with blockchain later on. And we will discuss later on how blockchain and decentralized systems will reverse the downside I was talking about, taking power away from centralized system and giving back control to people and without single point of failures. So we talked about reversing the downside of this digital calculus. Now we're going to talk about capturing the upside, because definitely technology, technological breakthroughs, research, AI, even in hardware system and GPUs, computational system, trying to build supercomputers, quantum computers is something fascinating and is definitely helping humankind on all sort of levels. But capturing the upside is not only about making technology deterministic, waiting to consume these technologies without having a say in how to consume it and without having a say in how to shape these technologies. So we need, by capturing the upside, to try to look at technology as being neutral, not deterministic, and put our human values on this. And specifically, I'm going to talk later on about AI, artificial intelligence, which is basically maybe our biggest hope and our biggest fear at the same time. So capturing the upward trend is embracing technology to solve real-world problems, but at the same time, shaping this technology. And remember when I've talked about the set of rules, the ESOS, talking about the security of technology and data, when I talked about integrity, confidentiality, and privacy, I was directly signaling about how to include these notion of confidentiality, privacy, preserving techniques, it's whatsoever, in capturing the upward trend of technology. So just a small recap for this part one. Maybe it could sound a lot to process, but it's a much needed introduction to try to frame where to tackle. I'm gonna use real world examples and talk about some sort of work we are doing to tackle this. But as a small recap, so to reverse the course of action within this digital calculus, or to redefine this digital calculus, we need to focus a lot about the set of rules we lack today, the set of ethos, which includes providing security for the users. When we talk about security, we talk about integrity, confidentiality, and privacy. To try to redefine a new digital calculus, a new digital stewardship, where humans, users, have control over their data. By control, I'm talking about ownership, having the right or access control to these data, and maybe later on decide how this set of data we are generating might be analyzed, monetized, sold, used to analyze whatsoever. So this is the first part, the bulk part of the talk, trying to introduce this notion of privacy preserving, a new privacy preserving internet in general. So moving forward to part two, so how? Basically, how can we do this? I'm gonna dive deeper in two technological notions, blockchain, AI, and try to, at the end, drawing a conclusion about this intersection between these two major technology, which I personally think is going to shape our future, will be the basis, or will provide the infrastructure to reach technological maturity, singularity, populating space, moving from AI, artificial intelligence. Yes, I can see these eyebrows, Mahmoud. Moving from AI, artificial intelligence, to AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, which we call it also super intelligence.
We can't even count votes, election votes, to him.
That's a different topic. I also have an opinion about this, which I think not counting votes, or taking too much time to count votes, especially in the US, what's happening. This is part of having an anti-fragile system, which is excellent for me.
Oh, look at you sounding all like Nassim Taleb and stuff. Interesting. Hey, go ahead.
Yes. So where were we? Okay. So
artificial general intelligence.
Artificial general intelligence. So exactly. So blockchain AI will be the basic infrastructure to work in the future towards reaching this big promise we have, which is creating a super intelligence. Creating machines, intelligence, able to create by themselves intelligence. So how can we do this? So we all hear about data being the new oil, data. The gold rush of our time is talking about AI. So every single startup is an AI-enabled service. We hear artificial intelligence news, building robots, whatsoever. So AI being the gold rush of our time, we need to define two major players within this sector. So we have the data owners and the data consumers. By data owners, we mean everyone owning data, being users, being companies, research companies, being governments, being banks, financial institutions, etc. And data consumers, we're talking about data scientists, researchers, consultants, everyone trying to build machine learning algorithms to train and try to predict over a set of data. So within this notion of AI, we have data owners, data consumers. Usually, or 80% of the times, data owners lacks the proper skills to analyze their data and try to extract value out of these data, because basically these usually are not maybe technical people. They lack the resources whatsoever. So there's an imminent need for both to collaborate. Data owners to share their data with data consumers, and for data consumers to try to clean these data, pre-process, building a machine learning algorithm, training more algorithms to reach high efficiency in prediction whatsoever. But the collaboration between these two comes at a risk, which is data breaches, regulation, when you talk about GDPR, HIPAA, et cetera, risk, many risks of these data being misused. So majority of data owners decide to drop the whole process because we lack the proper infrastructure where they can actually provide their data while preserving the privacy, confidentiality, and integrity of their data, and for other research team to try to work on these data to provide more solution to extract more value. So that's why there's an imminent need to create this proper infrastructure for privacy preserving environment where everyone can collaborate with each other over the data they have, and to build machine learning algos, artificial intelligence systems whatsoever, without having the need of trust between the two entities. Here comes the role of blockchain. So I assume everyone hears about Bitcoin, how to use Bitcoin, digital money, whatsoever. I'm not gonna talk about Bitcoin today. I'm gonna talk about actually the enabler of Bitcoin, which is the blockchain technology. I'm not gonna approach this subject in a super technical matter, but what I want you to take as a conclusion of what is actually the core of blockchain is basically trying to find consensus over the internet, or consensus between computers, machines. So what do we use to have consensus between each other as humans? We basically use the trust. I trust you, you trust me. So this is, we reach a consensus. Or we rely on government agencies or agreements, legal agreements. So the accountability I was talking about earlier. But when it comes to machines, how can I trust a machine not being a malignant node, not a benign node? How can I ensure that this machine is not controlled by a hacker that will try to break the consensus or steal my information whatsoever? So basically blockchain, without giving the technical terms of how blockchain is doing this, the conclusion is blockchain is a technology that enables the consensus mechanism between different machines, different computers, while preserving the integrity of the whole system. So assuming some nodes or some servers or some computers will act in a bad way, the system can absorb this these bad actors and provide a right consensus between the nodes. So blockchain enabled us to find consensus on the internet and provided us with the ability to record and prove ownership of anything we want. In this case, we're going to talk about ownership of data, set of data. So once it's recorded on the blockchain, any data owner can have the proofs that these data sets are owned by him and have the control over these data because he holds the decryption keys for this stored information on the internet. So this is basically how blockchain is helping the world in providing this extra layer of security regarding ownership of data and access control over the data. So creating this privacy preserving infrastructure is something super vital to have to provide this collaboration between data owner and data consumers to try to extract as much value from the data we have to try to solve many problems. If we do a basic search on the internet regarding machine learning projects, we find only pictures of dogs and cats. So a machine learning algo that predicts if this image is a dog or a cat. Don't get me wrong, this is actually quite an interesting project. But why aren't we working to solve real-world problem, cancer research, global warming, genetic therapy, whatsoever? Because accessing data is super hard. To try to build or and solve problems using AI, we need to access data. Why do we need to access data? Because we need this data to build this these algorithms and try to train it and enhance their accuracy of prediction. So accessing data is super hard because majority of these sensitive data, when you talk about healthcare related data, financial sector related data, defense, when we talk about government, etc., are all locked in data silos, because we have long thought that providing security on the internet is actually locking our data on the internet, putting these data in vaults, try to encrypt these data at rest. Well, actually, no. Now we do have technology techniques, technology breakthrough to provide what we call encryption in use. So basically, when I'm sending an email, let's say from Mahmoud to Mahmoud, our email are encrypted in transit while they move from one email to the other. When we store our data on the cloud, on the iCloud, on whatsoever, these data are encrypted at rest while they lay down at rest in the cloud without being used. So this was the modus operandi of how we talked about security on the internet. With technological breakthroughs, when we talk about homomorphic encryption, secure enclaves, cryptographic proof, all these big buzzwords, we now have the ability of introducing a new notion, which is encryption in use. What is encryption in use, basically? Encryption is in use is the ability to run a computation, for example, between data sets and machine learning algo and extracting result out of these computation while keeping both encrypted. So the machine learning algo doesn't have to decrypt these data to extract the value and complete the computation. And the data does not have to decrypt the machine learning algo. So this is encryption in use. So now security on the internet is not only about locking data and data silos and preventing researchers and the whole human race to extract as much value as possible. Now we are able to develop this privacy, confidentiality preserving ecosystem where I don't have to trust you, you don't have to trust me, you only have to verify that these cryptographic proofs will provide security at both ends between data owner and data consumer. So basically, this is the field of work I work in with a great team. Is actually at the intersection between blockchain and AI. How to enable both technologies to create this infrastructure where data owners, data consumers can collaborate in a privacy-preserving environment and to extract as much data as possible, to extract as much value as possible when it comes to real-world problems, not only pictures of cats and dogs. I've talked a lot in the first part about the ethos and why we need these ethos or new set of rules to govern the relationship between the computational system and the stakeholders. And actually, this was an introduction for the vision or why we need to create this type of infrastructure to enable people to try to develop solutions for problems. So I remember when we talked about this lecture and you asked me for a title for this, Mahmoud, if you can remember. So I've told you that let's call it More Builders, Less Consultants.
Yep.
And then we decided to keep it more politically correct to talk about tech stuff. But actually, why more builders and less consultants? Or what do I mean by we need more builders and less consultants? I'm not directly attacking the general consultancy sector in the world.
Yes, but you are.
I do believe. Okay, I'm trying to be a bit politically correct.
No, just say it.
but I actually believe that the way consultants or this sector we relied too much on this notion of consultants and how we conduct business, how we design institutions, how we draft policies on consultants, where the basic activity a consultant does is benchmark. So if we have a certain type of topic we need to address, we need to design a policy for, or try to build the new digital transformation in this new city of blah, blah. So what does consultants do? They benchmark. So we go research certain projects happening, let's say in Singapore, and try to implement the same set of rules and design systems whatsoever in southern Lebanon, which is actually where I think is the major flaw in this sector. But why we do this? Why would we assign consultants to work on these projects for this single most basic reason? If shit hits the fan, we can blame the consultant. We've outsourced this. Let's blame the consultant for this failure in the project because we don't have any skin in the game. Hence,
Nassim, three Nassim Taleb references. It's like,
let's see, Nassim owns Nassim.
I should give you an award, man. You're this? Doing that. Hey, people already are fed up with my Nassim Taleb references during my classes. So now another Mahmoud is just fedding them up with more Nassim
Taleb. They keep reproducing it. Showing up everywhere. So I'm saying this. So zero skin in the game. We outsource this service to build, to try to solve real world problems. And when shit hits the fan, we can blame the consultant. We've outsourced this consultant and with zero accountability to whoever hired these consultants.
And hence, the interesting part is that even consultants don't even, are not held accountable at the end of the day.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
So everyone blames it on this external, well, it happens, the market is fickle and whimsical and we don't know, it's unpredictable, so yeah.
Hence the need for builders. Actually, entrepreneurs, risk takers, people who spend too much time imagining the future, how the future might look like, and try to work from the present to reach there, or people finding real-world problems and risking a lot to try to find solution for these. So hence the saying, we need more builders and less consultants. And how is that related to everything I was talking about? Is actually, if we need more builders and less consultants, we need to create the proper infrastructure for that. Creating the proper infrastructure for that will enable these entrepreneurs to grow organically, hence pushing innovation, pushing the whole society, nations, people on a universal scale, towards technological maturity and creating this future we are trying to imagine or we are trying to reach. If the future is not biological, if the future will be full of super intelligent computers with the human cyborgs, people flying into space, coming out, coming in, etc. Yes, maybe. But the future should be human. And by human, I mean having human values within this technological world or this digital calculus. So this is, if I want you guys to take a small outcome of everything I was trying to say, is trying to work our daily life to take back control over our data, try to shape the future or the technological future we live in. We should always remember that technology is not deterministic. We should not only consume technology and let technology lead the way of how societies or how humans will interact between each other. We need to shape technology, bring in more human values to technology. And I think the first step to make the digital world more human is to start by giving back control to the user regarding their data, giving back the ownership to the user and the ability to control and the freedom of sharing or not sharing their data sets, their data, their information, whatsoever. We tend to use technically when we talk between developers, we refer to any sort of information as data. So sorry if I'm using the word data too much. So I'm really sorry. I think I've went. So it's close to 6 o'clock. I was trying to make it around 40 minutes, but if we can open up the questions, or to if you want me to dive deeper into certain specific topics I've mentioned, what do you think?
sorry. Just. Yes, thank you. I think, I'm not sure about the rest. I do have a couple of questions we can, you can maybe clarify before we even
please
open up the space for, or the floor for actual questions. If anyone has any question, you can write it in the chat first. We'll see. We'll let him respond, and then maybe we can open it up for a discussion later on. But first off, like this is what you said is very interesting. As someone who doesn't know anything about blockchain myself or crypto, except for the experience in crypto, particularly, I'm not going to be referring to Bitcoin, but I mean, I know what happens, how it works, but when it comes to blockchain and decentralizing the data across the globe, etc., how is this going to be? So my question is going to be maybe naive or whatever, but the idea is genuinely, I don't, from everything I've come across, how is this going to be helping the user or empowering the user in a way? This is first. And how is this going to be reflected in actually allowing researchers to use these data, like to come up with, to actually use the data to produce the research that you were talking about? And the last interesting anecdote is that if AI cannot recognize the difference between a bald guy's head and an actual football on the field, how do you expect, even if you have like the proper data, how do you expect that you will have like decent results? Yeah, so three different questions, Bassano, just because I am trying to understand how this is going to be empowering us with confidentiality and privacy issues, and how this is going to be helpful for researchers instead of having to sign all sorts of agreements. And
NDAs. Yeah. Yes. Okay. So to keep things super simple, so we have centralized systems, decentralized systems. Okay, so an example for a centralized system is actually GCP or Google's cloud platform. So Google has all sort of servers implemented globally, controlled by Google. So maybe this Zoom call or Zoom is built on top of GCP, of Google's cloud. And because we are right now in a certain geographical place, the interaction or the transit of data flowing out of the laptop to the server is located, let's say, in Dubai. Okay, so all the data is moving to the servers in and out of these servers. But at the macro level, all these servers are controlled by one centralized system owned by Google. So let's say something happens to Google, or Google decided to capitalize on all these data that is running in and out of their service. They have the ability to control or do whatever they want with all the data flowing in and out of their service. So this is the statu quo of how things are done on the internet before blockchain. So we've talked about centralized systems. Now with blockchains, with decentralized systems, actually people, normal people running nodes. So let's say my own computer in my living room, I could make this computer one of the servers used on the network. So the sum of all the servers used on any blockchain network is not controlled by one centralized authority or party. It is actually controlled by the rules of the system, and we don't have a single point of failure. If one of these people running a node or running a server on this decentralized system, if one of them decided to go off the system, it will not affect the integrity of the whole system, okay? Because you don't have a centralized decision maker, which is not the case to all centralized systems, etc. And your second question was how this will help people with their privacy, how to control their data. Actually, having your data stored or proof of ownership of any information stored on a blockchain gives you the ultimate proof of control over the information you have recorded on the blockchain and the trustless system where no one can reverse any transactions that has been recorded on the blockchain. So the pure nature of a blockchain network has these three main characteristics: being decentralized, so we don't have a single point of failure; the immutability, which means if the network reaches a consensus about a certain block of information, let's say Mahmoud Rasmi owns, let's say, this specific ID of a data. Once it's recorded on the ledger, on the big ledger of the network, no one can erase this. No hacker, no whatsoever. This gives you the proof of ownership and immutability, which is it's an append only system where you cannot go back or reverse what happened before. So this is for answering question number two. Question number three was, if you can help me,
how is this going to be helping researchers?
You're talking about if we're not able right now to design a machine learning algorithm that can predict the difference between a cat or a bald head or a...
But funny anecdote, it seems that like four or five people lost their connection and they're coming back because it was 6 p.m. I think.
Yes, true.
A power cut, but yes. Anyway, just, yeah. Yes.
So how actually this comes, we need to talk about two axes: the development of the hardware, making better computers able to run more complex computation on one hand, and on the other hand your answer is exactly what I was trying to talk about. If we had more access to data to train these machine learning algorithm or deep neural network, we would have this ability or more enhanced ML algorithms that can actually predict the difference between a bald head and a soccer ball or a football ball. So this is one of the problems why we don't have much accurate systems. So two reasons: we need to develop better computers, better supercomputers, having the ability to calculate more complex computations, and actually giving these researchers and data scientists more access to big set of data for them to train their models on these data, to have more enhanced algorithms.
Interesting. So I'm still looking at the questions and I'll ask them, and you don't have to worry about it. I'll not go in order. It's just Laura is asking, how will the solution you suggest, how will blockchain be, these systems be financed? This is one. And Roman is asking, I think it might be related, are there any practical steps to be taken to reclaim users' privacy? And is it possible at all using conventional means, OS software, software services, etc.?
Okay, excellent question. So to answer question number one regarding if I understood correctly, what kind of investment or resources do we need to finance these type of projects, right?
I think the question boils down to if maybe a centralized entity maybe is going to be financing them or
no.
Yeah.
Basically, the nature of public blockchains, the true nature of these networks is some sort of crowdfunding. So let's say I want to contribute to this network, to this decentralized network. So I will go and invest X amount of money from my own funds to buy these type of hardwares and to maintain these hardwares and to pay for the operational cost, mainly electricity. In return, miners or node operators will receive some sort of financial compensations versus the amount of energy, electricity they are providing to the network. This is basically how Bitcoin works. Miners/ node operators or server operators provide these computational power to the network, and they get in reward some sort of financial incentive, which is actually Bitcoin. So this is for the how to finance this. You need to think about it some sort of a crowd investment where everyone contributing to the network will invest some sort of money and will get back, will get in return these financial incentives. The second question was how to try, or what are the steps if we want to start right now with this?
To reclaim users' privacy, and is it possible at all using conventional means?
For me, first of all, how do we start? Awareness. What we are doing right now is actually talking more about why we need to redefine the digital calculus, why we need to make users on the internet more privacy aware, on the nature of how these private agencies on the internet is actually making profit out of these data. So first of all, awareness. We need to spread as much as possible this awareness. Number two, I can give an example, which is the end-to-end encryption recently enabled by WhatsApp. So actually, okay, so what is end-to-end encryption? We see this when we call on WhatsApp, on WhatsApp calls, so end-to-end encryption. End-to-end encryption means if we have phone A, phone B, so phone A is sending a message to phone B. Before that message is leaving phone A, it will be encrypted and transferred to user B, phone B locally on the cell phone holds the decryption key. So he can decrypt the message and read it. So now if let's say the Lebanese government, they need well to tap some sort of conversation between two users on WhatsApp, and they will go and pressure, imagine if the Lebanese government can do actually this, but they will go, let's say, to WhatsApp, to Facebook, basically, and try to force them to provide the log of this conversation. Before end-to-end encryption, yes, you can actually force this. You can use any sort of extortion, pressure on decentralized companies like Facebook, and to try to take this data under claims of national security, whatsoever, counterterrorism. But now with end-to-end encryption, Facebook can actually hand off the logs of the conversation to these, let's say, governmental authorities, encrypted by saying, we do not have the decryption key, which is true. Facebook now with end-to-end encryption on WhatsApp does not hold the decryption keys for this conversation. So this is an answer to yes, we do have privacy preserving encryption techniques right now to try to lower the gap and try to build this privacy preserving internet I was talking about earlier.
George is asking if blockchain or how can blockchain work with carbon markets?
What do you mean by carbon markets? Do you mean the carbon footprint released by these mining activities?
And as he writes, I'll jump to another question before he can clarify. Neji asks, do you think we can implement and use blockchain in the public sector in Lebanon? Feasible? And will this improve transparency? And which blockchain platform do you think will be the best choice for use? Hyper, Ledger, Ethereum, OpenChain, etc. You can, no need to answer all of them. Yeah, it's just if...
No, definitely. Definitely, we need to implement this in Lebanon and everywhere. The true nature or benefits of blockchain network is actually transparency, trackability, traceability, proof of ownership, etc. So yes, and I would think of maybe Ethereum for this type of projects.
Muhammad, with the implementation of blockchain in the different aspects of life, such as finance, won't we be needing a new political system that will stop governments from firmly grasping people's data while putting in mind the government's security concerns?
Well, that's a topic, and we need to talk for this topic. It's an excellent question, actually. I don't think I have a comprehensive answer to this, but yes, I agree. With Bitcoin, we had this revolution of a new way of having a monetary policy within this ecosystem called Bitcoin, which is a revolution. But again, it's a super complex topic to talk about or to answer right now. In a few seconds, but yes, a revolution, maybe. Yes, this will. So with the rise of DeFi, decentralized finance, where people can actually now have an alternative to the traditional financial sector, while we don't have the proper policies and regulation for that, but actually the accessibility I was talking about, where people are actually building technologies and making them accessible to anyone without waiting to any proper regulation and policies and implementation happening. So we are moving super fast on making decentralized technologies, making technologies more accessible and easy to use to people without having the proper knowledge regarding specific technological topics. We're making this more accessible to people, so people will jump into alternative and they will not wait to governments and whatsoever to try to implement their own new system or try to enhance or to innovate within this these rotten systems of bureaucracy, it's whatsoever. So yes, it's an interesting topic.
Yeah, we can maybe discuss this even further in a future lecture because it seems like a very pressing.
Yeah, it's a big topic, yes.
To talk about.
Yes.
Mike Azar is asking, how do you see the role of law enforcement and intelligence in the context of data privacy? So I think it's related to the question that Muhammad asked. For example, anti-money laundering, compliance, national security. And what policies or initiatives should Lebanon focus on to be competitive in this field?
Okay, so again, big question, super valid, an excellent one. So to try to reply to the first question, how law enforcement policies, etc., can deal with, or let's say cope with what I was saying, giving privacy, confidentiality to users, maybe beyond what the actual law says. I think it's a battle. It's a battle between the keeping the governance or power within centralized systems and actually giving some sort of power and control to the community. What I think should be the status or the way moving forward is by these ethos I was talking about, trying to reach consensus between the two players and how they interact within these computational systems. So again, to Snowden's example with this book on permanent record, now more and more people are privacy aware of what's happening. We definitely need rules, we definitely need laws, law enforcement, we need counter-terrorism measures. Maybe, yes, we need to tap in certain law for cellular lines, cellular towers, try to track down finances, forensic audit, for example. Yes, we definitely need this. But we also need policies and regulations protecting people with no possibility of or unflagged people, because the way it was happening earlier, it was mass surveillance, try to get as much as data on everyone, having this permanent record on everyone, good and bad people. So I think we need to reach some sort of consensus between two. How do we start this? We need to make users more privacy aware. We need to give, we need, what I like Heike to call it, making the digit, the analog rights we do have in the real world equal the digital rights we have on the internet, because right now it's not even. Well, the second question was,
how Lebanon. See the role of law enforcement and intelligence in the context.
Yes, we've answered this.
No, not this one. Yeah, sorry. What policies or initiatives should Lebanon public sector and private focus on to be competitive in this field?
I do have a super extreme position on this. And I'm not forcing my opinion, but I think we are lagging super behind. What I would do, but again, Lebanon is not a good example to throw in suggestions. I know it's a super spaghetti network. I don't know where to start. But actually, I would lift the ban and regulations and make it to zero right now so we can catch up. We cannot create a PayPal account in Lebanon. How am I allowed to talk about privacy preserving techniques?
Within Lebanon, we can't even have a fucking payment gateway.
Exactly, for freelancers.
Yes. So that's you guys can discuss that maybe even further. We can discuss
in a leftist cafe. Yes.
And a leftist / abstractive hippie cafe.
Yes.
Lamia / CC. It took a crisis, 2008, for the G20 to issue recommendations on financial literacy. Digital literacy, illiteracy is such an overlooked field. It is scary. Any insights? Also, are there systems that allow users to opt out of the digital space? Regulations to have a sort of human rights by design requirements? Let's start first with digital literacy, illiteracy.
No, but basically this is exactly the core of what I'm trying to say. Thank you, Lamia, for this. But basically this is the topic we are talking about. We are starting with the digital literacy and trying to bring back or to introduce people about the notion of privacy, confidentiality on the internet and to make them more aware about their digital rights on the internet. Sadly, for now, all we have is also decentralized initiatives run by people, and basically after crisis, like after Cambridge Analytica, we had super groups in London, in UK, in the States, in New York, exactly, trying to campaign for this digital rights, making people more privacy aware. What happened after the Snowden leaks? What happened after WikiLeaks, etc.? So yes, maybe we humans need always a crisis to try to to anticipate or try to like, you know, we tend to overlook major issues, major problems within our global society. But hey, we need crisis maybe to reflect on these topics.
Yeah, and I don't know if you can they opt out of the digital space? Are people allowed to opt out to be off the grid?
Again, that's command an excellent topic, but you know, I have a radical view towards this. Yeah, I personally think don't freak out. I actually think we are human cyborgs. We're not only humans at all. So look at your smartphone. If you're away from your smartphone for more than an hour, you feel something wrong. So this small machine, small hardware called smartphone is actually an extension to your biological brain and body, which is a mirror to the flow of data in and out, and is actually, and how we are human cyborgs, we are, this smartphone, it expands the bandwidth of our brain. So when we talk about sending a text or sending a picture, so let's say Instagram has a wider bandwidth than Twitter. If Twitter was only a message, only social media, okay? Why a higher bandwidth? Because we can communicate using pictures a larger number of information and bytes than we can do with text. So having this smartphone hooked with our hands 24 hours a day, expanding our brain's bandwidth, enhancing our cognitive powers in listening, in talking, in spreading the message. So maybe for me, no, we cannot opt out because we are officially human cyborgs.
It's very interesting, and
I'll
go back to the questions also shortly, but because I was listening to someone earlier today talk about this, the connectivity to social media and smartphones and devices that are powerful enough to have everyone hooked. Two questions come to mind. First, there's always this talk about inequality. There's this ideological view that views things in terms of we are in an unequal or inequality when it comes to our access to the cloud, etc. And how can this be maybe combated as well? The talk was to try to get people, but ironically, as more people are trying to, or many people on the one hand are trying to hook up absolutely everyone on the cloud, and other people are trying to stay off the cloud, a la Ted Kaczynski, the, you know.
Yes.
You know, yeah. It's so, and.
Actually, this is super interesting. And this is part of the more builders, less consultants topic. How bridging the gap, or how fighting this inequality. This is where entrepreneurs should jump in. Not making technology super related to the elites, the technical people. Actually designing solutions following two major axes. Accessibility. So what is accessibility? Basically is trying to build an infrastructure or build a product with the many layers of the back end, and actually, let's say, putting it on the web. So it is there. So we've made this technology accessible. So this is accessibility. And number two, also for builders, entrepreneurs, is the ease of use. So accessibility, making the solution there, but also not making consuming this solution super elitist. And only for the geeks and techie or people who actually do proper skills. And here comes the discussion about user experience, UI, UX, how to develop ease of use into softwares, SaaS, basically, to make these solutions accessible, but also easy to use. So I don't need to learn how cryptography works, but I can easily use WhatsApp that uses cryptography, and I will benefit from this. I don't have to be a cryptography researcher. So that's an answer for your question, how to fight this inequality.
But in certain places, like, for example, I'll give you Lebanon or maybe other places, you don't even have internet.
Again, dropping or extrapolating on this specific topic, internet. So we need to make internet more accessible. How?
Who's going to be incurring all the costs?
Again, that's why builders are risk takers and need to be rewarded, because this is how human evolution, or this is how they drive human evolution. They answer this type of question: who's gonna pay for this? How I'm gonna build this? You know, so who's gonna anchor the cost? Someone is gonna come and design a solution for this specific problem and make it easy to use and accessible. Hello, financial accessibility. That's a different topic, which I agree with you. Yeah, there's a big barrier when we talk about how to consume these services and can we afford this? But that's another topic. But I agree, yes, this is a big barrier to entry.
So George, what George meant was carbon markets, where countries have a certain limit to issue CO2 during...
Yes, exactly. A carbon footprint. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. So I'm a big preacher and of using renewable energy for mining, any type of cryptocurrency. So yes, mining cryptocurrency, or actually contributing to the network, having servers, is consuming energy in the world, like any other like industrial site. So we need to introduce more renewable energy solutions within the crypto community or crypto awareness. And this is something I think a lot of these crypto communities all over the world, than Bitcoin or Ethereum or any other project, is actually preaching for.
Another question by Lamia: how did COVID exacerbate the issue? This issue.
Well, again, Lamia, we need a head-to-head. Actually, I was personally thinking about this. How it's an interesting time to live in. COVID, the plague. The imminent need to collaborate between all human beings fighting this disease. So for me, we do have, it's a personal opinion, but thinking about COVID and the plague, I think we agree that humans need to collaborate. Talking about specifically COVID, we need to share the data. Countries need to share data between each other to try to find the cure, try to control the transmission, whatsoever. What's a big roadblock? Not making nations or countries to actually share their data. Exactly what I was talking about during the call. We don't have the proper infrastructure where people can actually collaborate and share their data for the benefit of the all, to extract the maximum value while protecting the integrity and confidentiality.
So something related to what you just said, Lul was asking, wouldn't decentralization destabilize centralized political systems, like, for example, China and other countries? Or maybe
political systems. Yes, I agree. I'm ready to open an all-nighter discussion about this, because actually this is one of the first and most important implication out of the core of what I'm trying to do. My answer is yes, but why yes? Yes, it will destabilize. Just as Bitcoin destabilized the whole financial system and monetary policy and how we actually consume transaction, between each other, financial transactions. Yes, decentralized systems, not only when we talk about money, يعني Bitcoin and so ever, yes, it will destabilize centralized government. Yes, it's a big issue and it's a big race between centralized authorities and open communities all over the world working on decentralized projects to compete. And I think, I personally think, we will converge into a new, a big paradigm shift, a change of how we know the world. So it's a constant battle between censorship, escaping censorship. So we have a saying, Yani. We say, they adapt, we adapt. It's a constant struggle. Censorship, centralized power, removing censorship, decentralized power. We will, at some point, converge into paradigm shift. Yes. With big discussion. That's a very nice question.
But, I mean... I'll get Abed's question also shortly, but I mean, look at Twitter. So it's something as simple as Twitter.
It's, yes.
They're censoring all sorts of tweets now.
So, true.
How do you combat that? And how, because the all this is maybe a different discussion, not only related to blockchain, but the idea here is how do you prevent misinformation? Or fake news, or fake data, if that is possible, whatever that is, like corrupting the system from within, and how do you? Because ultimately, you will still need some sort of gatekeeper, maybe. Because otherwise, do you think that we should just? No. How would you keep track of what's going on?
My specific point of view regarding this issue about U.S. elections and Twitter censorship, I related back exactly to what happened in 2016. So I think this is a reaction to what happened with Facebook and Cambridge Analytica's scandal. So basically, for people, so Cambridge Analytica is a firm located in the UK where. One presidential campaign back in 2016 paid a huge amount of money to try to manipulate political message on Facebook exactly. So buying data from Facebook regarding people, feeding these data to some sort of algorithm that predicts who to target exactly on Facebook with political campaign during the 2016's election. So this was a big scandal on how social media is affecting global society, politics. So I think what's happening now with Twitter is just a reaction to what happened back in 2016. So they went too far ahead, trying to introduce a solution. Maybe personally, I would think flagging out possible misleading tweets could be a consensus between censorship and deleting the tweets, banning people, and opening freedom of speech. But again, Mahmoud, it's finding the balance, finding the consensus. You've introduced this gatekeeper notion. Exactly. You need, yes, gatekeepers also in a decentralized world where gatekeepers are communities. That has the highest interest or incentive to keep the well-being of these networks. So it's okay. It's super complicated.
Thank you for keeping philosophy. Like you're basically giving me a job, because this is what we teach in virtue ethics. So many people now are starting to talk about virtue ethics and towards a more virtue ethics driven tech world. So
it is a points, super interesting topic. Yes.
Yeah. The points you're raising are basically related to topics we discuss in philosophy. The only difference is that philosophy is useless. We just discuss things in isolation, because ultimately we need to just discuss these issues in an abstractive hippie manner and then let the builders decide how it could
feel free. Keep the rant going on. Feel free.
Yeah. No, it's Abed's. While decentralized systems have their merits, centralized systems also present a lot of benefits. They are able to evolve and iterate faster. Think about how easy it is for WhatsApp to push a new feature compared to a piece of software that's not controlled by one entity. Think about HTTP protocol that's been almost the same since the 1990s.
I agree, yes. I'm not how super radical about...
challenges facing the decentralized systems when it comes to agility?
I totally agree with Abed. I'm not super right-wing about having everything decentralized whatsoever. Decentralized communities are still immature. Even technologies are immature regarding this. And yes, we have a lot of capturing. I've talked about capturing the upside. And yes, we do have an upside in centralized systems. The agility, how to develop lean softwares, etc. Yes, I do agree that we need to evolve, not in a radical matter, to try to find this hybrid solutions between eliminating single point of failures and finding agility within decentralized communities. So yes, excellent point.
So I think the discussion now shifted towards Zahi is asking about possible centralized decentralized systems collaboration, and I think the underlying problem here is not whether the system is centralized or decentralized, as you were saying. It's just finding the balance and trying to figure out an infrastructure that is more ethical.
The ethos, exactly, and exactly. This is my answer, because we cannot settle with black and white. We need an ethos to try to find this hybrid solution, as I've previously mentioned, or you have mentioned right now, Heike, between these, again, reversing the downside, capturing the upside. So creating more of what we want, less of what we don't. This is, I think, what I'm preaching right now is, this is how we need to approach complex matters, not only in blockchain, maybe also in Lebanese politics and economy. Well, we approach complex systems by reversing the downside, capturing gain on the upside.
That's a course that we can do. Virtue ethics in technology.
I'm ready.
Three lectures. Ella, of course, this one is going to be paid. Yeah,
I'm joking.
Lala, this is not. It's
you've asked if I was following football news, etc. I told you I lost interest. I don't have any hobbies since 2 years ago. Well, actually, this could be an escape for me as a hobby. So capitalize on this. Use this against me.
Of course, no, because I gave an ethics course two months ago. I think it's very interesting, and it's more interesting that it from two different perspectives: the theoretical aspect, looking at the theories, and then users and understanding your experience in a practical manner. It would be much more also beneficial. Decentralization and ownership needs the ethos through education awareness. Yep, we go back. And what kind of education and awareness? I personally think all sorts of education that is not happening in centralized academia.
Thank you. Please allow me to give the example of what you were doing with the classes online you were doing. So this is exactly what you were doing. I was preaching big notions and throwing out big words out there. Accessibility is of use. Actually, if we want to take you as a use case, you are a perfect representation of what I am trying to preach is philosophy, making the content accessible. So trying to read, to formulate the curriculum in a way accessible to many. The ease of use is actually using Zoom and the internet and the different timing and Arabic or English. This is exactly what I was saying. And you were doing this without knowing. So I'm just putting a title to the book.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it's funny because you always get these replies. So for example, so I had the saying Amin, where philosophy comes in, Aristotle popping in, which is virtue ethics. Abed wants to celebrate in New York. I think probably they finally announced that
Biden
won. And yeah, philosophy has a role in teaching ethics. I do agree. It's just the kind of, as we were just discussing, how to tackle these issues, how to create a discussion space to be able to raise this kind of awareness. And awareness whereby we don't impose on others what to think. It's just to get people to just think for themselves about these issues, so to be able to understand that there is this is what's going on in the tech world, which is where we need people like Dream and all those who are going to be giving the lectures. Over.
I hope, Yani, everyone will leave this or already left this. Again, we've talked about this previously with more questions than answers, because I don't think I have or I'm presenting any sort of answers. What I hope and I can accomplish is actually to initiate the discussion, initiate the thinking about how to develop this ethos within the digital world, digital calculus, how to redefine it, empowering people, not reducing people.
Do you want to talk a bit about what you do? Pitch it, actually, like, if you want to discuss more your company or something.
Actually, we exactly work within this space I was talking about. More specifically, we are developing a privacy-preserving machine learning platform. So we're bringing all these privacy-preserving techniques, cryptography techniques, blockchain. So AI and blockchain, merging those technologies and creating a platform just like TensorFlow, where majority of data scientists or machine learning builders use to create machine learning models and algorithms. So we are building this privacy-preserving platform to allow researchers, data scientists, people to collaborate over their data, extract value while preserving confidentiality and privacy. So this is exactly what we are trying to build. We did, actually.
Very interesting. So if anyone would want to further ask you questions,
I will share with you a list of I think interesting readings regarding certain topics I've mentioned, and maybe Mahmoud, you can share this with anyone who's interested in these readings, small readings, audiobooks, articles, research, etc. And anyone, feel free to reach out whenever you want over Twitter if you want to ask any questions. And thank you so much for this. It was really exciting. I will leave this session also with more questions than answers. So I hope you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. This was interesting, and I'll open maybe the last 2 to 5 minutes. If anyone wants to say something, share your thoughts or anything you want to say, maybe audio. You can spam Dream's DMs at Dream.
Yes, feel free.
And I'll be uploading this talk shortly on YouTube. I'll be making it available to the public as well, and I'll send you all the email of the link. So if anyone wants to say anything, you feel free to. Cheers. So any final words?
Thank you, guys.
Dream?
Thank you, Catherine. That's it. Thank you all. Thank you. It was a real pleasure. Hala, I can go back to troll on Twitter.
Indeed. All too serious. Yeah, I'll recording now.